Where are we now with this economy? I mean, anybody know? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 23rd of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with an anniversary of sorts. Not a precise date thing, more like a, it's been a year thing. 1 year this month since the Fed started raising interest rates. 2 years, give or take, since we started talking about rate increases in the face of what was at the time being called, I'm sure you remember, transitory inflation. And as we all know, a lot has happened in this economy since then. So as we do sometimes, especially when the economic news is moving kind of fast, we've asked Marketplace's Kristen Schwab to slow us down for a second and take stock of where we are.
Remember the olden days, like 2 years ago, when everyone talked about inflation like it was a fleeting moment in time? Lawrence Ball is an economist at Johns Hopkins.
There were a lot of people ranging from Jerome Powell all the way down to me, who dismissed this as a transitory blip that would soon go away.
The T word, transitory, was not the name of the game. But Ball says even though inflation remains sticky,
it doesn't look as though we've gotten into this pernicious spiral of inflation's high, so it's expected to stay high.
That's what happened during the 1970s, the great inflation period that lasted almost two decades. Sebastian Malaby is an economist at the Council on Foreign Relations.
So in that sense, a year is not very long. It's long compared to other bouts of raising interest rates.
Malaby's talking about the mid-90s, around the year 2000, and again around 2005, when inflation rates were both lower and less widespread. And Anil Kashyap, an economist at the University of Chicago, says the Fed dealt with the problem differently.
The Fed was more preemptive. You know, there was like 2 years where every meeting they boosted the interest rate by 25 basis points.
He says this time around, the Fed wanted to see inflation to believe it and not cool the economy too quickly after COVID and its supply chain snarls.
I think we're paying a little bit of a price for that now. I think we'll be talking about this next year as well.
That would bring us to 3 years of inflation, an anniversary that seems pretty solid, but in the grand scheme of inflation history, doesn't exactly qualify as a long-term relationship. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The Bank of England said this morning it's raising interest rates over there a quarter of a percentage point, just like the Federal Reserve did yesterday. And if you have noticed in days past that a lot of central banks tend to do a lot of things in coordination with one another, they do. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the whys and the hows.
There are different levels of global central bank coordination. When everything is hunky-dory, the world's central bankers just keep in touch. David Wilcox is a senior economist at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and at Bloomberg Economics.
In normal times, there's lots of ordinary information sharing.
But these, of course, are not normal economic times.
When financial markets are more turbulent, there's a second level of coordination, and that involves these swap lines.
Swap lines. That's where the U.S. swaps dollars for other countries' currencies. At the beginning of this week, the Fed announced it would hold these swaps every day instead of weekly. Ann Owen, a former Fed economist now at Hamilton College, says during times of financial stress, like now, people turn to dollars. And the Fed wants to be sure there are plenty to go around because
people are very, very anxious about the possibility that there could be more bank runs if people believe that banks are not able to meet their short-term obligations.
Now, during the 2008 financial crisis, the Fed went to level three, coordinating interest rates with other countries. The Fed does all this because in a global economy, it can't meet its goals of low inflation and maximum employment alone. Robert Sacken is another former Fed economist, now at Citigroup.
It really benefits the Fed if trade flows aren't interrupted, and if other countries don't experience financial stability issues, because those have a high risk of coming back and hitting the U.S. economy.
Sacken says ideally the outcome of all this coordination is avoiding financial drama, so all the central bankers can do their jobs. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders were in a better mood. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Ford Motor Company said today it figures it's going to lose about $3 billion this year on its electric vehicle business. The company started selling its first electric car in this country in 2020. It says it expects its EV business to start turning a profit by 2026. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on the internal combustion to electric transition.
Launching one new car, even just a new gas-powered one, is always expensive for automakers.
Because they get knocked off their efficiencies of producing.
Tyson Jomini at J.D. Power says the auto industry is all about efficiency. Churning out a whole lot of the same car or similar ones is key to how companies make money.
Like Henry Ford said, you can get any Model T you want so long as it's black. You know, that was done for efficiency reasons, right?
So launching a whole new division to make a whole new kind of car, kind of a bumpy ride.
You have to think about Ford Model E, that EV business, effectively as a startup within Ford.
T.R. Reid, a spokesperson for Ford, says making gas-powered cars and making EVs,
it's significantly different.
For all traditional car makers, getting into the electric vehicle market requires massive investment, says Michelle Krebs at Cox Automotive.
It's all new. They're teaching workers how to build these. They're building new plants. That's a huge part of the expense. Every automaker is building new assembly plants, new battery production plants, and those aren't cheap.
The time that it's taking to make this transition and get customers on board is also costing automakers money, says Jessica Trancic at MIT.
Really understanding what consumers are looking for and building up momentum on the demand side.
Right now, just 6% of cars being sold are electric, so there's a long way to go. Trancic says this is all just part of the process of making something new. It's not unique to electric cars.
In general, when we look at really the development of any technology, what you see is that it typically requires an upfront investment in research and development.
That, she says, tends to pay off many times over down the line. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
We were just hearing from Sam about how tough it is for car companies to make that EV switch. Consumers are already sold. From 2021 to 2022, EV sales increased 60%, 60%, to more than 10 million units. That is worldwide. And yes, it's from a small base, but the motor vehicle future is kind of already here. That said, just as there are upstream issues in making EVs, there are downstream issues, too, in particular in fixing them. Emily Chung owns the auto repair shop Auto Niche. That's up in Markham, Ontario, Canada. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me here.
If I say electric vehicle to you, what do you, as an auto repair shop and auto repair technician, what do you think?
I think there's lots of opportunity in electric vehicles, and there's always that piece about, okay, how are we going to repair them now? So that's always the crux of the issue for us.
Well, let's walk through that. You as a woman running a small business, you know, let's say some EV rolls in there and maybe you've seen it before, maybe you haven't, maybe it's not a Tesla, right? There's a zillion of those, but yeah. Something else. Do you know what to do on these EVs?
So here's the deal is that when you look at it compared to a conventional, you know, engine, That engine has been standardized for years over, right? In terms of the EV, though, every manufacturer has their own way of doing things. And so it becomes more of a challenge for us as aftermarket technicians when we don't have access to the information, because essentially I'm trying to diagnose a vehicle that I don't really know, you know, how they made it or what the specifications need to be.
A lot of technicians and repair professionals have gone through training at the dealership. Is that something that EV dealers are doing for you yet? Or sorry, at the manufacturer even.
Yeah. Right? So a lot of right now it's becoming more and more of a brand specific type of industry, which is not really helpful for us. When you start getting to the road of making us, you know, brand specific technicians, then it really does limit the amount of employment that we can have. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. And let me just put on the consumer hat for a minute here, right? If I buy an EV from brand X, does that mean, generally speaking, I have to deal with brand X dealerships to get my car fixed and I can't take it to an aftermarket place like yours with the same expectation of service? Yet, exactly.
For now, because we don't have access to a lot of the information, we can still do, for the most part, a lot of the maintenance side of things. You know, with the EVs, as they start becoming more prominent in the marketplace and as they start aging, you know, a lot of these vehicles will come to the aftermarket shop. And to be very honest with you, dealerships right now are swamped with recalls and warranty work. So for a consumer end, you may run into the issue where if your local garage doesn't have access to training or information, then you will be stuck with going to, you know, very limited places, the dealership specifically, to get that work done.
Can I ask you the pipeline question? You know, there are vocational technical schools. There are ways for people to get into the line of work that you are in. I don't know how you got there, but is there that pipeline for EVs yet? Can't be, right? I mean, it's such a new market.
Well, that's the thing, is that as much as the government wants to push EVs, it's almost like there's so many factors happening in this industry, right? You have infrastructure, you have the supply side on the manufacturer side, but then you also have the repair side for us. And there are some colleges that already have like EV training. At the same time, it's very limited right now. And it's only to the amount that the manufacturers want to release information as well.
Say more about that.
So because I don't have information on this vehicle, it's like asking me to do surgery on somebody who I don't know where the organs and everything are located, right? I'm going in blind almost. Yeah. And to your point about the consumer, I think that's something that they may not have considered just yet because the EVs have only just recently taken off in popularity.
Right, right. There is a seemingly inexhaustible supply of internal combustion engines out there. So you're not, I mean, this isn't going to affect your bottom line, right?
I don't think it'll affect the bottom line for now. At the same time, it's definitely something if we're a forward-thinking shop, like we're moving into it. The other piece about the consumer side is you might be thinking, okay, you know what? I have to head to the dealer to get the vehicle fixed. And in my area, there's, you know, a dealer that you could relatively access easily. That might be okay. But I'm thinking of people who are in more rural areas and to ask them to drive for, you know, an hour to get the nearest dealer is not reasonable when there are garages local to them. So that's the other piece that we think of when it comes to this issue.
Right. Emily Chung, she's the owner of and a technician at Auto Niche. That's an auto repair shop up in Markham, Ontario. Emily, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
it will find you the answer whether or not it actually exists.
AI chatbots, eager to please, maybe not to be trusted, though. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 75 today, 0.2%, 32,105. NASDAQ also up 117 points, 1%, 11,787. S&P 500 rose 11 points, 0.3%, 39.48. Shares in the electronics company Toshiba jumped 8.7% today. That's after the company announced a $15 billion buyout deal with a private equity firm in Japan. Investors are still, it turns out, a little uneasy about the banking system, even after the Fed and Treasury Secretary Yellen are doing whatever they can do to calm the waters. Trading in regional banks was down. Zions Bank dipped 8.8% today. Western Alliance down 2%. New York Community Bank slipped 1.7%. Sam was talking about Ford's losses in its EV division. Ford shares drove down about 0.5% today. Bond prices went the other way. They were up, thus the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.40%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I mentioned the messaging tightrope that Fed Chair Jay Powell had to walk yesterday between acknowledging the challenges in the banking system right now, yet reassuring people it's safe. Safe enough, in fact, that he can keep raising interest rates. Well, come now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen with her own tightrope. She said yesterday the administration is not considering blanket insurance for all U.S. bank deposits. But in remarks prepared for testimony to a House Appropriations Subcommittee today, she said Treasury is prepared to act if needed. That if needed thing is important because the real risk here is contagion, right? And not even actual contagion, but just people and businesses thinking their money might not be safe because once that happens, out the door those deposits go. So Marketplace's Justin Ho has been talking to some small business owners to find out how they are looking at this whole banking debacle.
One of the questions weighing on the minds of many small business owners is, if the crisis gets worse, will the government step in and save my bank?
To be candid, our business has an account at a community bank, and we are going to be opening another account at Chase because it's too big to fail.
That's Nate Tobik. He's the founder of Complete Bank Data, a company that sells market data to banks. It also needs banking services of its own. He says, look, moving the money is a rational decision because the federal government saved the biggest banks after the 2008 financial crisis.
I mean, if the government has said that we will never let JP Morgan fail, and it's like, okay, well, I know if we have some operating money there, then that money is basically guaranteed by the government.
Tobik says he's concerned that smaller banks' profits will erode if they have to raise the interest rates they pay to retain customers. But that's not much of a problem for bigger banks.
They have such a diversified business line that they're not reliant on those deposits and the longer-term fixed loans that a community bank is.
But the big issue at play for most small businesses is the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the $250,000 per depositor limit on its coverage.
Which is a decent amount of money, but like, you know, businesses could have $100,000 a week payroll.
That's Spiro Papadopoulos. He's the CEO of Schlau Restaurant Group, which operates 7 businesses in several states. In the past week, he's opened about a dozen new accounts at different banks to spread out his money and increase his FDIC insurance coverage. And like Nate Tobik, he's doing that at bigger banks.
We're not leaving the smaller banks, but we're not leaving excess of $250,000 at smaller banks.
Papadopoulos says he wants to maintain his relationships with smaller banks, but he says it's more convenient to open new accounts for his businesses at banks that serve all of the markets he operates in. It also helps that bigger banks tend to have more sophisticated technology.
So opening accounts, getting, you know, security verifications done, apps on your phone, all that stuff is much better with the bigger banks for the most part.
Some businesses aren't making any changes to their banking relationships. Tiffany Turner is the CEO of Adrift Hospitality, which operates hotels and restaurants on the Oregon and Washington coasts. She says there's a benefit to keeping her money at her community bank.
It's keeping your dollars local where they're going to continue to work for you rather than shipping them off somewhere else. Many, many mom and pops. And how we got started was banking with our local community-based bank.
Turner says keeping her money at the bank can help ensure that it keeps lending to her community.
This isn't just about our business thriving. It's also about our employees thriving. And that means like good schools and good hospitals and, you know, like just a strong community. It means we want people to want to live here, to work in our businesses.
Turner says if her community bank failed, she thinks small businesses in her area would have a harder time getting the banking services they need. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, I talked to an AI researcher named Janelle Shane about AI-generated cat pictures. Yes, cats, because at the time, AI was pretty good at generating faces, less good at generating cats. I talked to her because Janelle's got a blog called AI Weirdness, where she gets AI to do all kinds of things like write love poems or recipes or impersonate a squirrel.
This was sort of in reaction to this sort of message that people were worried when these algorithms would claim to be self-aware. Mm-hmm. And I said, look, you know, just because it describes the experience of being a self-aware robot from science fiction doesn't mean that it actually is one. Because here, look, this one's describing the experience of being a squirrel.
It's a nutty life, but someone's gotta live it. I spend my days scurrying about, gathering acorns, and trying to avoid predators.
So, given all the news the past few months about AI acting weird, we asked Janelle to come back and explain today's chatbots.
These modern chatbots are all trained to imitate internet text. And what people who are selling these as products are trying to do is trying to get them to predict a web page in which there is a dialogue between a user and a helpful chatbot.
Is it sort of like leading the witness, right? I can guide its responses?
Exactly. And this is why you'll see its responses getting guided in all sorts of different ways. Right. And how people describe hacking these chatbots is more like convincing it that it's on a different website. It's telling a different sort of story. Like you maybe think, oh, actually, this dialogue is happening in this context of a science fiction story.
Right.
And so now it's starting to fill in the lines of a science fiction chatbot.
And that's how, broadly speaking, we got to the whole Kevin Roos story in the New York Times, where it starts calling itself Sydney and falls in love with Kevin Roos, or tried to convince him that he was in love with it. I can't even remember.
Yeah. Yeah. And probably the longer the dialogue gets, the more likely it is to say, well, you know, chances are this is a science fiction story we're in. And right. The more the user nudges it toward, oh, what are your feelings? Don't you feel upset? The more likely it is to fall into these sort of very well-worn science fiction tropes. Mm. It's all us. You know, it's all a mirror of science fiction.
All right. So look, let me get you to the marketplace of this thing. People mm-hmm. are monetizing this already. You know, Google's out with its new thing and Microsoft is doing its thing and big companies are involved. My question is, how long before it becomes ubiquitous in this economy, do you suppose?
Good question. I think it has more to do with what companies are feeling pressured into coming out with a product because their competitors are. Versus what actually makes sense as a solution to a problem.
Yeah, say more about that, right? Because what is the problem that this kind of AI is trying to fix?
This is the problem. It's like a solution. It's like a internet chatbot in search of an application. And so mm-hmm. some of the applications we've seen it applied to, like the big one that Bing is using now, they're using it as an internet search algorithm. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that it's trained to generate statistically probable text in a dialogue between a human and a helpful chatbot.
Yeah.
It will find you the answer to what you're looking for, whether or not it actually exists.
So which is terrifying on a lot of levels. But look,
yeah.
you are an expert in this, and it's not out of the realm of possibility that some company, big or small, is going to come to you and say, Janelle, we want to engage your services as a consultant to help guide us through the monetization and the introduction into a product of these chatbots. What is your advice sort of as we sit here in early-ish 2023?
I think it is most useful if it's giving suggestions to a human who knows that its suggestions are not to be trusted. Maybe a customer service situation where suggesting responses and the agent can say, ah, yes, that sounds good, and click on it and it's what they meant to say. Things like that, where you have a human in the loop serving as a check. These kinds of things I see as much more possible to make work than something that's very open-ended.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. What is your, and again, you're the expert in this conversation, what's your level of concern about us getting this out into society and into the economy without really having thought through the ramifications, which is a very human thing to do, if I can mix my metaphors here?
Yeah, I think there are problems with what we've done so far. I mean, we're seeing the workloads on teachers increase as they have to figure out what to do with generated essay submissions. There's a science fiction magazine, Clark's World, that had to close their submissions because people kept flooding it. So it was exponential, this increase. The FTC just released recommendations trying to sort out this sort of AI fakery should not be on the consumer. It should really be on the people releasing these tools to think about how they could be misused.
Janelle Shane, she's an AI researcher. Also, she blogs at AI Weirdness. Janelle, thanks a lot. I appreciate your expertise.
Hey, thanks so much. This has been fun.
This final note on the way out today, offered without knowing whether the marketplace bosses are listening right now. The new CEO at Starbucks, Lakshman Narasimhan, told the Wall Street Journal in an interview that he is going to work as a barista 4 hours a month just to understand the job and why it can be so hard. A different store every time, so keep your eyes out. Might be yours. Narasimhan also said he's going to make senior leaders at that coffee company do the same thing. Now, about those marketplace bosses. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Call it a preview, really, of the soon-to-be-upon-us spring home buying season. Freddie Mac, the government-owned mortgage conglomerate, said today the average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage dropped again this week, second week in a row that it's fallen down to 6.42%. A year ago, for what it's worth, 4.42%. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Bibawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.